Welcome to the Kitchen Counter Podcast, episode 201. Happy Holidays. Everybody, thank you so much for downloading and listening to this episode of the show. I am Roger, your host, and this is the podcast all about home cooking. And this time, we're a little bit holiday flavored. I've got a holiday episode lined up for you today. We're going to be hearing from some friends on some different holiday season themed food and beverages. I myself actually am sipping on a hot buttered rum here as I talk to you. So hopefully you're able to grab a seasonally appropriate or seasonally inappropriate drink for that matter. It doesn't matter to me. As long as you're comfy and ready to settle in for a little holiday themed podcasting, we're all good here. Really quick before I get sidetracked, I will mention show notes for this episode will be over at kitchencounterpodcast.com/201. Now I'm going to be hearing from some friends and they're going to be sharing some different recipes or tips and tricks on cooking different things. When we're talking about recipes, I'm going to put either links to the recipes in the show notes or the actual recipes themselves in the show notes. But listen through because on a couple of these, you really get the nuance of how the dish is put together. And well, what are we going to be talking about, you ask? Well, we're going to be talking about cookies and mulled wine and the holiday time dish I bet you've never made, which is a turkey bone gumbo. We're going to be talking about all of that in today's episode. So don't miss out, kitchencounterpodcast.com/201. Also, you can send a note to me if you'd like to get in touch by email to feedback@kitchencounterpodcast.com. And we're on all the socials. I lurk around those things too. We have a great Facebook group over at kitchencounterpodcast.com/group, if that's your style. So I was feeling a little nostalgic this holiday. I don't know if you're like this too, but you know, with the pandemic and everything, I think I bring it up in every episode and I get so tired of it. But such is life, right? Anyway, I was feeling a little nostalgic and I was looking through some old pictures. Now, several years ago after my dad passed away, we had a lot of his slides digitized, his transparencies. For you youngins, way back in the day, that was like one of the main ways you took photographs on little transparencies. And they were kind of a pain because really the only way you could look at them was either in a projector. I mean, you could hold them up to the light and look at them, but they're tiny. They're like, you know, an inch and a half wide by like an inch tall or something. They're super tiny. So you either have to put them in a projector to look at them, or we had this cool little device that looked a little screen on one end that you looked in and then a little slot on top where you stuck the slide and you pushed it down. A little light would come on behind the slide and then the little screen would magnify and you could look at it and you could see what the pictures were there too. But anyway, my sister had all of my dad's slides digitized at one point. So now I have them all digitally. And anyway, I was looking through these and I came across a batch of them that are dated 1979 to 1980. So this would have been me at 4/5 years old. And there are actually a few Christmas pictures in here. I'm going to actually put one in the show notes of yours truly. It appears I'm either hanging an ornament on the tree or perhaps getting caught in the act of doing something to the lights on the tree that I shouldn't be doing. I can't exactly tell. I think I'm hanging an ornament. Looks like I just ate something chocolatey and sticky. And somebody snapped a picture of me while I was doing something in the tree. But what struck me about this picture more than anything, two things actually, was the tree. And if you're a Christmas tree person, or even if you're not, I mean, you know what like a Christmas tree looks like, right? It's like a green fir tree. It's kind of got that triangular shape. You know, star on top, whatever. This tree is perfectly round. It's like a giant ball, and it's a real tree. Didn't have any fake trees back then. It's a real tree, but it's almost perfectly round. It's like a Christmas bush. And I know it's not fully decorated because typically it would just be draped with tinsel. You know, that shiny, you can't even buy it now, I don't think, but that shiny plasticky silvery or gold or whatever stuff you'd drape all over the tree. And it would make a huge mess. Anyway, there's no tinsel on it yet, so I know we're not done decorating it. But I'm looking at this, and it's like I don't ever remember the Christmas trees in my house being this shape. I mean, the Christmas tree we have up now is pretty standard Christmas tree, you know, shape, kind of that triangular look. There's also in this picture a fascinating picture of it's a leopard print, not like leopard print, like the pattern, but like a print of a leopard in the grass on the wall. I have no idea why we had that photo. And I think maybe one of my sisters ended up with it. I'm not sure, but it's a great picture all the way around. It makes me very nostalgic for the good old days when I was, you know, preschool. But I look at it and I wonder, is my son today, he's 9, but is he going to, in, you know, 30, 35 years, whatever, going to look back at pictures that we took, you know, within the last few years and go like, wow, I can't believe our tree looked like that. Or it just blows my mind how things can change so much and you don't even realize. And I know I'm not the only one who had a round tree, because I talked to my wife and her family often had round trees. So I think it was a thing. Anyway, I'll put the picture of it in the show notes. But it got me thinking, like, I don't remember much of the food around Christmas time, interestingly. I remember Thanksgiving dinner very vividly. And Christmas Eve, we would typically get together as a family and have snacks, you know, meats and cheeses and baked goods and things like that. Not a proper meal, per se. And I think maybe on Christmas Day, we had a sit-down dinner that probably looked a lot like Thanksgiving dinner. But I really don't remember Christmas dinner really at all, which I thought was kind of interesting, that I don't really remember the food of Christmas, besides maybe beyond cinnamon rolls and a couple of baked snack things like that, or the meat and cheese plate. But there's a point to this story. So I'm going through these pictures, and then there's a folder in here I forgot about, which we also had a bunch of my mom's recipes, handwritten recipes, you know, on paper, recipe cards, scraps, whatever. We had those scanned as well, so we have those digitally. So I was going through those, and then I came across my mom's recipe for hot buttered rum mix. And then I remembered, oh yeah, I remember hot buttered rum. I remember the flavor. I remember the aroma of that, because my parents would make the mix every year. So I actually took my mom's recipe here and made myself a batch. And I'll put the recipe in the show notes as well. So I'm enjoying that right now as I record this podcast episode. We are not an eggnog family. So I guess if you're not an eggnog family, you got to go hot buttered rum. But if you've never had hot buttered rum, you make a mix. Some people call it a batter. Our particular mix is mixed with vanilla ice cream, but it's all the warm spices and flavors. It's, first of all, there's butter, of course. And then in our recipe, there's brown sugar, powdered sugar, cloves, nutmeg, cinnamon. I like to add some allspice. And then that's all mixed together until it's creamed together with the butter. And then it's mixed into vanilla ice cream, and then you put it back in the freezer. And then whenever you want a hot buttered rum, you heat up some water like you were going to make, say, tea or hot chocolate. You put a dollop, a big fat, you know, kitchen tablespoon dollop of or more of the mix in your mug. And then you pour the hot water in, stir it up. You know, you can put whipped cream in it or marshmallows or whatever you want. But you've got this very warm, spicy drink that actually you don't even have to add rum to. So it's a great drink for kids, too, if they want sort of a fun, festive, seasonal drink that they can, you know, participate in, but they don't need any alcohol or anything in it. You can make hot buttered rum. But then, of course, you would just put an ounce of rum or whatever, or however much rum you wanted to as you mixed it all up, and then you'd have a hot buttered rum or a hot buttered nut rum, if that's the way you want to go. So I'll share the recipe for that. We're actually going to be talking about mulled wine in a little bit, too, which will be another beverage that's great for this time of year. So here I am drinking some nostalgic drinks, looking at some nostalgic pictures, getting ready for Christmas 2021. Now, a lot of you know my wife likes to bake, right? She's the baker in the family, although I've been, you know, trying to grow my baking muscles over the past couple of years and getting a little more comfortable with it. But we have this slate of Christmas cookies that we like to make every year. It's your ginger molasses. We've got like the snowball cookies and, of course, the Christmas cutout sugar cookies that are frosted and decorated. We have all these cookies that we make every year, but we've been kind of looking for something a little bit different to make. And that's when I came across this really cool recipe in the New York Times. They're actually doing a feature right now called the 24 Days of Cookies, where they have 24 different types of cookie recipes. Some are very traditional holiday cookies. Some are not so traditional. And that's what my wife and I were kind of on the lookout for, was something maybe a little bit different. And I came across this really cool recipe for a hibiscus spiraled ginger cookie. So I thought, well, that looks amazing, and it's a little bit different, not, certainly outside of my comfort zone. So I whipped up a batch of these, and I have to say they were great. My son loved them. My wife thought they were fantastic. If you're looking for something new and interesting on the cookie plate this year, there's still plenty of time to give these cookies a try. There's a lot of other great cookies in that lineup too, I should note, in the 24 Days of Cookies, all of which I will put a link to in the show notes. So let's hop in our sleigh, head over to Brooklyn, and we're going to talk with Yuande Komolafe about her amazing hibiscus spiraled ginger cookies. Yuande, thanks so much for being here today.
Of course, thanks for having me.
This is perfect because we were just chatting a minute ago, but I was just saying that my wife and I were kind of on the hunt for a new holiday cookie. You know, we've got all the traditional candidates, right? We've got the ginger molasses, we've got the chocolate crinkle, the sugar cookie cutouts. But we were like, oh, I just want to do something a little different.
Yeah.
And came across your hibiscus spiraled cookie recipe, and it looked amazing. So I actually made a batch this weekend.
Amazing.
Yeah. And I am not a baker, and they came out, the recipe was perfect.
Oh, I love to hear that, especially the part where you say you're not a baker, because I want these recipes to be approachable for everyone, baker or not.
Yeah, totally nailed it. Now, I do know my way around the kitchen. I'm just usually baking stuff does not turn out for me, but these were pretty amazing. And I even had my 9-year-old son try it, and he thought these are pretty good. He goes, I really like the crust. It's cute. So
that's funny. Oh, but no, that's really great. That makes me feel good. Thank you.
So how did you come up with this idea for a holiday cookie like this? And did you have any inspiration on the ingredients or memories?
I do. So one thing about me and sweets in general, I really love plain things. Like I would kill a box of like shortbread cookies or a pound cake with no frosting. Like that's like, I love just like flour, butter, sugar, and I don't want it to be interrupted by anything. And so I was thinking of how best to take my, like what, to, how to take my love for like plain things and incorporate some holiday like cheer and spirit and spice into it. And I came up with the idea for the hibiscus cookies, because hibiscus is, as I grew up in Nigeria, I grew up in Lagos. Hibiscus is something that we use a lot. We use hibiscus leaves in cooking. We use the flowers in, for like a drink called Zobo, and that's like usually spiked with ginger. And for some reason, those colors to me, that like deep red combined with like the pale cookie just was like, oh, that would be pretty to look at. And I would eat that cookie because it's got no frosting. It's kind of very direct. And so I thought of combining the two flavors. And one thing about hibiscus is that it's tough to incorporate into baked goods. If I mix it into the dough, I felt like the dough would, like you wouldn't really taste it. You know, it's got this really tart taste to it and this like floral taste to it. And so I really wanted people to experience the hibiscus by itself. And so I thought of like doing a spiral with just like the ground up flower buds. And that's sort of how I came up with that recipe. And everything in that cookie sort of like overlaps with hibiscus. They're all flavors that go together.
Yeah, it's wonderful. And you and I are cut from the same cloth, because you know those Danish cookies, the butter yes. cookies in the tins. Like I tell people, that's my favorite Christmas cookie. And they're yes. like, are you weird? I'm like, are you kidding me? I can knock out a whole tin of those things.
That's amazing. Yes, that's me. Or like the Walker's shortbread. That's yes. another thing.
Yes. Like. They're the yeah. best. Simple is best.
So it's just like simple, straightforward.
I love the hibiscus too, because not only does it have this like tart, I guess like an analog would be like lemony cranberry, almost like a sumac kind yeah, of a flavor. Yeah,
absolutely.
But it's so,
all of those.
Yeah, it's pretty. I mean, the spiral takes on this really deep red, purplish, and then the turbinado sugar. It's almost like little purple snow swirled totally. Into this cookie. It's very striking.
And so, for someone who didn't grow up with like snow, that's actually a really great compliment.
Yeah, it looks wonderful. So let's talk about hibiscus just for a second, because you talked about it a little bit. I had to search a little bit to find a good source of hibiscus on short notice in town here in Salem. I didn't quite make it to the Latin market, which probably would have had it, but I did check out the local health food store and they had hibiscus tea, which was pure hibiscus, in tea bags. And so I just used that and
that's
it worked
great.
It worked great. It was pre-ground. It was already like powdered, essentially. Yeah. It took a lot of tea bags to cut open to get enough, but it worked great. So is that something, did I do that right?
Yeah, no, absolutely. I think I put a note in the recipe that if you're using hibiscus tea, just make sure it's straight hibiscus tea, because sometimes it's spiked with like rose hips or other flavors that you might not want in the cookie. So if you're using hibiscus tea, that's absolutely a good way to get the hibiscus flowers ground up like that in a tea bag. But you just want to make sure that it's only hibiscus, because sometimes it could be mixed up with other things.
And for me, just one more quick thing on the cookie itself. Actually, the hibiscus was fantastic, but the candied ginger studded in the dough.
Yeah.
So you just have this little chewy bite every once in a while.
Yep.
It really is a fantastic cookie. So I'm definitely gonna convince people to try this. If you didn't have hibiscus and you couldn't find it, because we're getting close, you know, to Christmas, for example. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't want people to mess with your recipe too much, but is there something else they could use?
Of course. Yeah, there's substitutions. I think that if you didn't have hibiscus, you could substitute with freeze-dried fruit, like freeze-dried raspberries or cranberries, anything tart, I think you could substitute with. But you do want it to be a powder of sorts, or like a dehydrated product of sorts. And that would really mess with the recipe that much.
So I've never made a spiral cookie before. And I sound like I'm bragging here, but I'm constantly amazing myself at the baking skills I assumed I didn't have, but it turned out great. And it looks so different and decorative compared to other cookies on the plate.
Yeah, I wanted something that would stand out in a cookie box. I think cookie boxes or plates are common around this time of the year. And I wanted something that people would immediately be attracted to, like visually. And so that's where the spiral came in mind. I also thought of like coating the edge. It could be just a plain shortbread with a coated edge, but I really wanted people to get a taste of the hibiscus. And that's why I opted for a spiral.
Yeah, I'm going to be baking more in general, but I'm going to be baking more with hibiscus, I think, because that's
amazing. Very great. You should flavor. Also try the drink if you haven't. Just like steep it like you would tea.
Well, I've got some tea left and I haven't tried it yet, but I think I will. It has that very tart, lively flavor.
Totally. It's like ruby red and very tart. It's a pleasure. It's a very pleasing flavor, I think.
Yes. So your hibiscus spiral ginger cookies are part of the 24 days of cookies in the New York Times cooking feature. Yuwandi, where else can people find you if they're interested? Because I know you've got some other recipes, of course, at New York Times, but I think you have a great Instagram page and such.
Of course. Yeah. So my Instagram page, I just wrote a kid's cookbook based on the waffles and mochi. Based on the Waffles and Mochi Netflix TV show. So there's recipes in that book as well. Most of my stuff is on New York Times Cooking because I'm a columnist there. But they can also find me on Instagram at Yuwande_Kadalafe.
Okay. And I'll put all those links in the show notes as well. So Yuwande, thank you so much for stopping by and filling me in on your amazing cookies. And I hope you have a fantastic holiday and amazing New Year.
Too. I hope you do too. Is it cold where you are?
Is it cold? Well, everything's relative. I mean, you're in Brooklyn. I probably can't say it's cold. It was a little icy this morning. It was 32 degrees this morning. What is it where you're at?
It's about 42, I think, today.
Okay. It's cold. Yeah. Then it's cold here.
It's definitely cold. Yeah.
Thank you so much.
Well, it's lovely to meet you. Thank you for having me.
Likewise. Always a pleasure. Come back anytime. These are really, really good cookies. In fact, after I made them, I had to throw a few right in the freezer because I knew of a couple people that I wanted to try them, but I wasn't going to see them for like a week. So I'll probably end up making another batch to put in some cookie boxes and things like that. But really, really a fantastic cookie and kind of fun to use an ingredient that I typically don't cook with, hibiscus. All right, let's get back on the spice train here. There's a very common or famous or comfortable, I'm not sure what adjective to use, drink that is found all over the place during the holiday, winter holiday season, and that's mulled wine. Now, I don't make mulled wine. I've had it before. I've drunk it before, but it's not something that is really part of my holiday history or holiday memories, if you will. So I recruited my friend Brian Diaz of the NOLA Drink Show, one of the sister shows of mine on the Nitty Grits podcast, the network out of the Southern Food and Beverage Museum in New Orleans. Brian is going to give us a crash course on mulled wine. Now, there is a lot more to this conversation than I've been able to fit in here. So Brian sent me a recipe for mulled wine with extensive notes. I'll probably include most of those in the show notes. So if you want to get even more information on mulled wine, head over to the show notes where Brian's recipe will be. But for now, let's get back in the sleigh, hop on down to New Orleans, and see what Brian can teach us about mulled wine. Hey, Brian, happy holidays. How are you doing?
Good, Roger. Happy holidays to you, man. How's it going?
Good, good. Hey, I hear you've got some insight or some tips and tricks for us folks who might want to make some special holiday beverages this season.
Yeah, absolutely. Obviously, great season for drinks. When is it not really?
Yeah, I was like, well, yeah.
I feel like I say that every time. But yeah, so, you know, obviously, for most of us in the world, at least in the Northern Hemisphere and climate change notwithstanding, it's a colder time of year. So it's always fun to do warm beverages. And then I think it's really fun that, you know, if you're entertaining doing something, when you kind of take that batched approach or do a larger volume approach of something easy that you can put out, keep warm, people can ladle for themselves into a cup with some holiday cheer. And yeah, so mulled wine is one of my favorites.
Is mulled wine, and maybe you haven't thought about this yet, but is it a regional thing, or is it kind of like all over the United States you're going to find mulled wine?
I think you kind of see it. I mean, that's a great question. I think you kind of see it everywhere if people are into it. I mean, you know, I mostly associate it with Europe because I think that's kind of where it comes from. So Vin Chaud, as they call it in French, or Glühwein in Germany. And one of my favorite experiences, I was actually in France for the holidays, probably 20 years ago. And it was actually out in Versailles, and it was cold, you know, and sitting outside and by a heat lamp. And I just, you know, ordered a glass of mulled wine. And I obviously had it before here in the States, but it was just something about sitting in Versailles on a square in town, cold outside, drinking some Vin Chaud. And it was just lovely. And so I just kind of always clicked with me emotionally during the holidays.
What do I start with? I guess my first question, I'm going to ask you a couple of questions, and I sure. know you got this in the bag, but what kind of wine? I mean, red wine, I assume, but I mean, do I have to get expensive wine? Can I get by with less expensive wine?
Yes, yeah, certainly the classic is red. And that's kind of the first tip. Yeah, Roger, you nailed it, is what wine to use. So no, don't use expensive wine because we're going to be adding pretty potent spices to it. We're going to be adding, you know, some sort of sweetener to it. Typically, the thing to do is to really consider the wine that you have. And what I mean by that is, like, generally something young and fruity is pretty good. I tend to not want something overly oaky because that woodiness still kind of sticks through the whole process. So one of the things that I recommend, because I tend to use more than one bottle if you're making this for entertaining, so either using a couple bottles or like a 1.5 liter. And if you go to a wine shop, you can get a 1.5 liter of some pretty decent French wine for $15, $18 a bottle, like just sort of a bulk Rhone wine or, you know, any sort of Pied Oak, you know, kind of general country appellation. Malbec does fine. I would just stay away. Merlot's great. Zinfandel, you know, if you're looking at New World stuff, does really well. Stay away from things like Pinot Noir because they're just too light in body and too light in flavor, and they're just going to get run over by everything that you're doing. Taste your wine and then kind of just a little sip and then evaluate. So if you got something that's like a really young Zinfandel that's very fruity, then that might affect if you decide to use any fruit in your mulled wine at all. And then I think the biggest one is when you have residual sugar. And we don't have to go into too much detail, but some wines, and it's very common in New World wines in particular, and imported wines from certain parts of the world, because it's for the quote unquote American palate, they stop fermentation and it leaves residual sugar. So all the sugar hasn't been turned into alcohol yet is basically what it comes down to. So if you've got something that's pretty sweet and got a good amount of residual sugar, or RS as we call it, then you need to be careful with the sweetener that you use because the wine's already bringing sweet. So I tend to kind of use like a 1.5 liter of just kind of easy drinking French wine because that tends to have less residual sugar and it's, I don't want to say it's a blank palate because that's not really what it is, but it doesn't have as much. It's going to run in, cause you problems, I guess is the way to put it.
I guess my second question then would be mulling spices. And you've already talked about fruit. You've already alluded to spices. What spices do you use? And there's probably as many recipes as there are people that make mulled wine, but what are some of the traditional, and then do you have any ingredients that might be a little different or, you know, kick it up a notch?
Yeah, it's a great question. I think kind of when you're talking about classic red mulled wine, the three big ones, the triumvirate there is going to be star anise, cinnamon, and clove. Now, one tip that I do want to give to people is the more that you can use whole dry spices, the better off you are, because eventually, you know, we're going to want to strain this off. Or, you know, and you don't want to end up with sediment or anything like that. Now, look, if you don't have cinnamon sticks, for example, which would be preferred to use, and you're using already, you know, powdered cinnamon that way, you can whisk it in and most of it'll kind of, you know, basically merge into the wine and it'll be fine. But, you know, where you can, and I try and do this across the board, is I use whole spices. And I think you just kind of get a better flavor. But to answer your question, so those are kind of the three, you know, big ones, like we talked about cinnamon and star anise in particular, and even cloves, you know, they're so powerful that you've got to be careful with how much you use. And we can kind of get into some technique there, but allspice berries, that's a must for me. Cardamom is a really, really good one as well. What some people will do with cardamom is they'll break the seeds out of the husks and then put the seeds just in a pan a little bit and just, you know, light heat, medium, low heat, that'll activate some of the aromatics. And then if you're actually using like a pan to do the wine in or a pot on your stove, then you can just add all the ingredients after that, including the wine and the rest of the spices. But it's a good trick with cardamom. I think, you know that from cooking to activate the aromatics. Vanilla bean is another really good one. That would be something to be careful with if you're using like a heavily French oaked wine that's already bringing notes of vanilla. So just, you know, be careful that way. Nutmeg is always a favorite. Kind of random stuff. You can even use sweet peppercorns. Need to be careful with that, but telecherry or pink peppercorns can do really well. Some people will just garnish with that and actually not mull the wine with it. Not a bad way to do it. Fruit, a lot of people traditionally use orange and they'll cut orange wheels and put that in. And then if you're kind of concerned about bitterness, you can, you know, peel the orange and then just have a little bit of the pith and the wheel goes in there. I put it as optional in my recipe because I tend not to like it so much. I think it kind of makes it a little cloying if you use orange. And I think if you're doing enough spices, and I'm going to get to a couple key ingredients that we need in addition to spices, I just find that you don't need it. And so, I mean, for me, the go-tos, just to kind of recap, are cinnamon, whole cloves, star anise, allspice berries, and cardamom and nutmeg are the ones that I tend to use.
But it sounds like there's some room for experimentation here. You know, you start with the general common spices, or you mix and match however you see fit and have some fun with it.
Two ingredients that I think are really, really important in this, in addition to wine, Roger, are brandy and dry curacao, or some people would say orange liqueur, so they'll say like Cointreau, for example. I'm a big fan of a product called Dry Curacao. Probably the most noted brand is Pierre Ferrand Dry Curacao. So it's an orange liqueur, but it's dry with a bit of bitterness and orange note. It's not a sweet orange liqueur like you would get in blue curacao and like in tropical drinks, right? So it doesn't heighten the sweetness, because mulled wine, we want some sweetness. When you cook wine, it becomes a little more bitter and a little more astringent in this regard. So we do need to offset it with some sweet, but I also don't want it to drink like, you know, a Slurpee. It's not, it does have to have some dryness and some bitterness and herbalness to it. what people will say recommend if you're using a one bottle ratio. So 750 milliliter bottle of wine would be a quarter cup of brandy or a quarter cup of orange liqueur. I tend to, like I said, I tend to do two bottles or a 1.5 liter. So what I like to do is I'll do a quarter cup of brandy, just a cheap VSOP, same process with wine. Don't spend too much money. Masson, Paul Masson, you know, that like VSOP, their brandy's just fine. But I tend to do a quarter cup of that and a quarter cup of the Pierre Ferrand dry Curacao, which brings the orange note and it's not overly sweet. And then that's why I tend to stay away from using fresh oranges, because I'm bringing it in with the liqueur. And so with the sweetener, sugar is just fine. I would tend to use like a, you know, toasted sugar, like Demerara or something would be my choice. Maple syrup, awesome to use in this. And honey, one of those works really, really well too. And I kind of find like the maple syrup does something to the body of it. And it just is a pleasant, I think it's a pleasant sweetening note. So I do recommend those.
Okay, let's talk about the process of actually making it. It's almost like making tea, right? It's like gently steeping all of these ingredients in the wine to impart their flavors. And is this like a stovetop thing? You can just put in a saucepan and let it simmer?
When you are simmering anything with alcohol, wine, you know, in particular, it starts to vaporize at 172 degrees Fahrenheit. I think a lot of us know that. So that's one of the tricks here, tips here, is you need to be incredibly careful with the temperature at which you're mulling the wine and doing it this way. Bring it up to temperature where you're just about to simmer.
Okay.
And so maybe the tiniest hint of bubbles, okay. You can certainly use like a confection thermometer or something. Keep it at about 170, 168 in that range. So what I like to do, Roger, is I actually like to do it on the stove in a pan or a saucepan or, you know, pot of some sort. I think a little bit of surface area is not a bad thing to have when you're kind of steeping these ingredients. So they're all kind of, you know, spread out a little bit. But I like to do it on the stove for about 30 minutes. But then what I do, and we run down the recipe, I guess we can talk about this. I kind of will add my spices on the low end of the range that I'm going to give you. Most of them, I'm giving you a range based on doing this to taste. But I'll do it first where I put, you know, about half the amount of each one in that I think I may use. And then at about 15 minutes, simmering it or just shy of simmering it, like we're talking about, then I taste it. And then I say, okay, do I need a little more of this, a little more of this? And that next 15 minutes, I'll introduce any more of stuff that I want to add. And then if like we're doing the party thing, I'll put it in the slow cooker and put it on warm so that it still kind of macerates a little bit and stuff like that. But then you're not going to be cooking it. It can sit there for 3 hours and people can serve themselves.
So when you're talking about mulling wine, I mean, this is actually a fairly short process then.
Oh yeah. It's actually, I mean, you can do it for as little as 15 minutes. I wouldn't go any less than that. Like if you're confident that you've nailed your spice level, 15 minutes and then serve it up. You know, some people will do it for like in a slow cooker for 3 hours. I find that say 15 to 30, like I said, I like to do about 30 minutes and then put it in the slow cooker on warm because it's still going to be drawing flavor even at that warm temperature.
Wow. Okay. Yeah. I was under the impression this was like hours long thing, which I guess it could be, but it's good to know that this is really something you could put together, you know, in half an hour if you needed to. Well, Brian, thank you for stopping by and sharing a little holiday drink advice. And I hope you have a wonderful holiday, an amazing new year.
Roger, thank you so much from the NOLA Drink Show. And you and your family have a happy holidays, happy new year. And I know I'll be seeing you soon.
I never knew there was so much to mulled wine because I've never made it, but there's a lot to it. It's simple, but there's a lot of room for complexity that you can bring to the table. So it's kind of interesting. I'm going to try a batch of mulled wine this year when I have some family come over and see how everyone likes it. I don't think I left it in here in this conversation with Brian, but I think at the end I was telling him, because mulled wine isn't part of my tradition or memories really of the holidays, I kind of always equated it with another one of those holiday things, holiday staples that really I have no reference on, and that's fruitcake. Maybe that's totally unfair, but I've always kind of thought of mulled wine as the fruitcake of the beverage world when it comes to holiday stuff. I think that's totally unfounded and unfair. And I'm gonna give mulled wine a shot here this season and see what kind of fun I can have with it. So Brian, thank you so much for swinging by and giving me the rundown on how to make a great mulled wine. As I mentioned in the show notes, I'll put Brian's recipe in his notes as well, so you can give it a shot yourself if it's something you haven't made. I'm curious if you are a mulled wine maker and drinker. you know, send me a note. I'm curious to know what your recipe is and how you like to make it. All right, we don't have to get back in the sleigh just yet. We can hang out in New Orleans a little bit longer because Liz Williams, who's a founder of the Southern Food and Beverage Museum in New Orleans and has the Tip of the Tongue podcast, was chatting with her the other day, and she filled me in on a kind of a family, secret family recipe. Maybe it's not secret, but a recipe that she's quite well known for and one that I've never heard of, but then I'm not from the South either, so maybe that's not saying anything. She has a very cool spin on a traditional gumbo where she uses leftover turkey from either Thanksgiving or a holiday meal or something like that. So she has this recipe for a turkey bone gumbo that sounds amazing. And I'll tell you, one of the most interesting things I learned in this conversation with Liz was that she glazes her turkey with Barq's root beer. And it's really cool because you may know or you may not know that one of the traditional ingredients in a gumbo is filet, which is a powder that's made from leaves of the sassafras tree. And sassafras is a very prominent flavor ingredient in Barq's root beer. So very cool that she does that and incorporates that flavor into the finished dish for this turkey bone gumbo. So if you've got a holiday gathering where you're going to be cooking up a turkey, definitely have a listen to this because I think there's a whole new life waiting for you for your turkey leftovers. Liz, happy holidays.
And the same to you. Happy to be here.
Yes, I'm happy you're here too. So I hear a rumor that I have it on good authority that you have some famous use for a very typical holiday leftover. Is that true?
That is true. Yes. So it's not something that I see very often in articles or tip sheets about what to do with your turkey leftovers. So I think it might be a new thing for a lot of people.
Now, typically after Thanksgiving and you know, Thanksgiving, Christmas are two big turkey holidays for my family and probably most families in the States. Typically what I will do if I don't use my turkey right away, my leftovers, is I will somehow take it apart and throw it in the freezer. Uh-huh. So maybe I'll make stock with it later or something like that. So stock to me is like, or soup, you know, that's like an obvious thing to do with a turkey leftover.
So I make a turkey bone gumbo and it is really my version of a gumbo, but then instead of the traditional trappings of gumbo, which mean that you would serve it over rice or whatever, I use the sort of Cajun method. So the Cajuns very famously have a scoop of potato salad in their gumbo. And so I said, well, if you can use potato salad, you can put a scoop of leftover cornbread dressing with oysters in your gumbo. And that is really great. And then if you really want to gild the lily, you can take a little tiny bit of your leftover homemade cranberry sauce and just kind of put that on top too.
We were chatting offline a little bit ago. I'm not a Southerner. So I mean, I know what gumbo is, obviously, but I don't really cook gumbo. So can you walk through just the general process of like how you put a turkey bone gumbo together? And I know we'll have the recipe here too. So if people want to check it out, they can head over to the website. But what are the broad steps of this?
Well, of course, you have a turkey. Now, in order to enhance the flavor of the gravy when I'm making the turkey, and I'm always thinking ahead to the gumbo that will come, I put down in the baking pan, first I oil it with olive oil, and then I spread out carrots. And then on top of the carrots, I put sliced onions. And then I put the turkey on top of that. And then I stick it in the oven. And I probably will empty about one bottle of dry white wine in there too. And then you put it in the oven, you let it cook till the turkey is really cooked. I don't like that perfect looking turkey. I want it to start to sag, you know, and then it really releases its juices and all of that sort of thing. You take the turkey out of the roasting pan, and then I kind of find that, generally speaking, the onions have totally disintegrated into the broth that's left, but you have to kind of pull out the carrots, and the little bits of the carrots might stay in because they've been in there long enough to kind of fall apart. And then you use that to make your gravy. Mm-hmm. Now, there have been times when I have used Barks soft drink, which is, it's one of Coca-Cola's products.
But it's a root beer, right?
It is a root beer, okay. And it was invented in New Orleans, okay. And it was always a very sharp, not too sweet root beer. When Coca-Cola bought it, they made it much sweeter than it was originally. And it used to be the thing that you would do is you'd buy a po' boy and a Barks, and that was, you know, that was your great, you know, lunch or something. Yeah. But anyway, there's a lot of sassafras in the Barks recipe, and sassafras is the basis for filet. So dried sassafras leaves are ground up, and that's what we call filet. Mm-hmm. That is a very American thing. It was used by the native people to thicken their soups and stews and things like that, because it is a thickener. But well, the root.
I first learned about filet from Hank Williams. So,
yes.
Right?
Yes.
Jambalaya.
Totally. Yeah. Yes.
Yeah. Crawfish pie and filet gumbo.
Exactly. Exactly. And then the roots of the sassafras tree are what go into a root beer. So, and if you smell it, it smells just like root beer. The roots smell just like root beer. So I used to use a little bit of Barks too, because it was so dark and brown. And I would use it as a little bit of a glaze on the, you know, a cooked glaze. I mean, I didn't put it on just raw, but, you know, you pour it on raw, sure. And then you cook it. And so then you had this kind of bronzy element on your turkey, more bronze than just baking it alone. But it would add a little bit of an extra interesting flavor to the stuff that you were going to make your gravy out of. So then the next day, you've got all this leftover turkey, and you've got the carcass of the turkey, and you have all this leftover gravy. So I use that to make a gumbo. And I try to use bacon fat or duck fat, whichever one I can get my hands on, as the fat to make the roux. And so you make a semi-dark roux, not like all the way crazy to duck gumbo dark.
Okay.
But you know, it's approaching coffee colored, not quite there, but almost between peanut butter and coffee.
Okay.
And you get your roux to the right color. You dump in all of your you before you put in your gravy, you put in your Trinity, your onions and green peppers and celery, and you sort of cook those down in the hot roux so that all of that sort of happens. And if you do that first with your onions, before you add the celery or the green peppers, it caramelizes the onions. And so that adds an additional sweetness to things. Then you throw in your gravy, all the leftover gravy, and then you add in your carcass. And I usually try to put my carcass in some kind of a mesh bag or something so okay. that it's easy for me to take it out. I don't have to fish it out one bone at a time. And then you chop up your meat or break it up with your hands or whatever and throw that in. And then you fill up the rest of the pot with water or water and wine, depending on how much extra wine you have left over. And you put it up to the top of whatever is in there so that, you know, there's a bulk of the bones and the meat and you, raise it to being even. Mm-hmm. And then you throw in your seasonings. So you're going to put in some salt and pepper and a couple of bay leaves, maybe three bay leaves, depends on how big the bay leaves are. And then some cayenne and some, maybe a little bit of thyme. And I also throw in some minced garlic and some things like that. And so then you put the lid on and you start to just let it simmer. And you're probably going to simmer it for 2 or 3 hours. And then you take out, I often, and this is one of those, it's variable. If I have a whole lot of meat, I don't do it. But if we had a whole lot of people over and the turkey was eaten up, you know, I might throw in some andouille or something like that to give it some more bulk, you know. And then when it's cooked, I take my leftover, and I always plan the leftover so that there will be leftovers. I plan for leftovers. I put in my cornbread dressing, which is always full of oysters. So you get that good. And then I use that as my scoop. Instead of a scoop of rice, I put in the bowl, a scoop of dressing, which is, of course, already heated up. And so then you get oysters and turkey and maybe andouille all together. And then if I have some leftover cranberry sauce, you could just have a little spoon of that on top of it. And that, and if you really, really want to, you know, make this intellectual circle, you could sprinkle maybe a quarter teaspoon or less, maybe an eighth of a teaspoon on your, in your bowl with some filet. And then if you put in the barks, then you've got that nice reference, you know.
Clearly, I have been underachieving on my leftover turkey. So now I feel like I feel like the gauntlet has been thrown down now. That sounds amazing. I have to say, in fact, I might just buy a little turkey the day before or a few days before Christmas, just so I can make some of this for the holiday, because it sounds incredible. Thank you so much. I feel very privileged that you're sharing like a secret family recipe. Maybe it's not secret, but
it's not secret, but it, you know, it is something that I think I sort of got to be known for. And so I think it's just so much better than a sandwich that has turkey on it and maybe some cranberry sauce. And then you say, okay, this is leftovers, you know?
Well, Liz, thank you so much. I hope you and yours have an amazing holiday and a happy new year.
And the same to you. That's, I think we all want an amazing 2022.
I don't know about you, but it almost sounds worth buying a plane ticket to New Orleans just so I can show up on Liz's front door the day after Christmas so I can get my hands on some of that turkey bone gumbo. It sounds pretty darn good. So her recipe will be over at the show notes again, kitchencounterpodcast.com/201. Thank you, Liz, for sharing that kind of secret family recipe. I'm dying to know if anyone gives us a shot and what they think of it. Well, I hope you enjoyed the sampling of holiday flavors we saw today. Yuande's great hibiscus spiral ginger cookie. Definitely try that if it sounds interesting. If I can pull it off, you can definitely do it too. Take Brian's advice and pick up your favorite mulling spices and fruits for your mulled wine. Thanks to Brian Diaz at the NOLA Drink Show for sharing all that mulled wine wisdom. Hey, also, don't forget the hot buttered rum mix. I'll put the recipe for that in the show notes as well. And remember, if you're a turkey person and you're making turkey for holiday meals or whenever, you're definitely going to want to try out Liz Williams' turkey bone gumbo. So Liz, with the Southern Food and Beverage Museum and the Tip of the Tongue podcast, thanks so much for sharing your secret family recipe. I know you told me it's not really secret, but I'm still going to call it that because it sounds much more intriguing. And thanks to all of you who have listened to the podcast over the past year, who have sent me emails or engaged with me on social media. I really, really appreciate it. You know, I do this for the love of the food and the love of the cooking, and that you appreciate that and join in on the community we've built here really, really does mean a lot to me. So thank you so much. I hope you and your family have an amazing holiday season full of joy, love, and hope. And I hope your 2022 starts off and delivers everything you need it to be. I'll be signing off for the rest of the year, but I'll be back in January with new episodes. So until then, I'm Roger with the Kitchen Counter Podcast. Happy holidays and happy cooking.